Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update from Israel on the growing tensions between Israelis and Palestinians that may portend a third intifada breaking out, and speak with the former spokesman for Shimon Peres, Gideon Levy, who is a columnist and member of the board of Haaretz, where he writes the Twilight Zone column on the Israeli occupation. Following official denials by Netanyahu spokesman Mark Regev, we will examine how much the threat to close off Palestinian access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque is perception or reality inflamed by the statements and actions of Netanyahu's cabinet ministers and other right-wing politicians who seem intent on provoking Palestinian rage. Then we will speak with veteran CIA Middle East operative Robert Baer, who is now the National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN, about rising Cold War tensions between the U.S. and Russia in the Mediterranean as Russian submarines shadow ships and aircraft carriers of the Sixth Fleet off Syria, where Turkey just shot down a Russian drone, and deconfliction of the airspace over Syria remains problematic. We'll also discuss Iran's deployment of troops into Syria and assess whether the recent P5+1 deal with Iran has freed up their hardliners to work closer with Russia against the U.S. while they increase domestic pressure on Iran's moderate president, Rouhani. Then finally, we'll speak with the Washington Post's Pulitzer Prize-winning author, Joby Warrick, about his new book, Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS, and discuss how this virulent strain of militant Islam behind the rise of ISIS began in a remote Jordanian prison and spread with the unwitting aid of two American presidents. And joining us now is Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He is the former spokesman for Shimon Peres and writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza for over 25 years. His latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gideon Levy.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
And Mark Regev, the spokesperson for Prime Minister Netanyahu, was on television saying that all of the paranoia on the part of the Palestinians about the Temple Mount Al-Aqsa being restricted in any way to the Palestinians is a total lie. And, of course, we've been hearing this for some time. Abbas said that the Israelis are attacking our religion. So is this brewing third intifada based upon reality or paranoia or perception? I mean, what is the spark that's causing this problem?
Unfortunately, it's not a lie. And one should see reality through the eyes of the Palestinian people, a people who lives under a very brutal occupation over 47 years now. And when it comes to the Temple Mount, which is right now the motivation or the main reason for this uprising, it's quite wrong to say that they have no reason to be afraid, because they exaggerate some fears, but the fears have very good reasons. They see Israeli ministers, members of the Israeli cabinet, provoke them in going and praying on the Temple Mount. They hear the declaration of the right-wingers about demolishing the mosques there and rebuilding the Jewish temple. This is not anymore just marginal people in Israeli politics. And, you know, you don't need much to be afraid from the Israeli occupation. The Israeli occupation has already a record of really brutalizing its behavior more and more from year to year. And everything is possible, and they cannot wait until the mosque will be destroyed and then to start their protest. They'll start the protest right now, when the danger is still far away, but it's getting closer.
Well, specifically then, which ministers are we talking about? Naftali Bennett, or can you name some of the ministers who've been praying at the Temple Mount?
Sure. Uri Ariel, Minister of Agriculture, a senior member of the government, goes there again and again. The Deputy Foreign Minister, Tzipi Khotoveli, and others, and their declarations are quite provocative, and so are their deeds. It's true that the official position is that the status quo will be kept. But, you know, it doesn't take much to create fear for a people who lives under this brutal reality. But this is only the excuse. The real motivation for this uprising is the continuance of the occupation without any kind of hope, without any kind of horizon to put an end to it. That's the real broader context. And here nobody can deny, including not Mr. Regev, that the Palestinians are living under a criminal, brutal occupation.
And is anybody in the press or in the security services pointing out to these politicians that previous intifadas were sparked by a perception that the Israelis were going to close down access to Al-Aqsa, the third holiest shrine in Islam?
No need to remind them. They remember it very well, and they do it deliberately to light a new fire, because the right-wingers want another uprising, so Israel will continue its occupation in a more brutal way. They are very interested in lighting those fires again and again, only to prove that there is no Palestinian partner, that there is no way to have any kind of peaceful relations with the Palestinians, because look how aggressive and violent they are after they provoke them.
Again, I'm speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's the former spokesman for Shimon Peres and writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which for the last 25 years has covered the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. And he's the author of The Punishment of Gaza. So Prime Minister Netanyahu has, of course, a very right-wing coalition in his government. Is he paralyzed by this fact that the people that you're talking about that are provoking this possible third intifada are in his cabinet, or is he able to be the adult in the room?
The question is, does he want to be the adult in the room? I'm not sure Mr. Netanyahu wants to be the adult in the room, because he could have picked up another coalition and he could have picked up different positions. Don't forget that Netanyahu by himself is an extreme right-winger and a nationalist. So he chose his position. He's powerful enough to do almost whatever he wants, and he chooses the very extreme nationalistic path.
Well, then this would get us to the end game, or the lack of an end game. If you are Netanyahu and you are allowing this situation to get out of control, and that's what most of the commentators are saying, is that there's a lack of leadership both on the Palestinian and the Israeli side, and the situation is spiraling out of control. If indeed Netanyahu wants it to get out of control and wants to crack down further, at what point do you think Netanyahu is going to come forward and speak honestly about what the Israeli right's endgame is vis-a-vis the Palestinian?
First of all, I don't think that Netanyahu wants it to get out of control. Netanyahu wants to keep the status quo. But this is impossible, because the status quo cannot be kept as it is, because it is an unacceptable status quo by the Palestinians. He is not ready to do any kind of change in the status quo which will enable the Palestinians some kind of hope. Now, once he goes to this policy, it must lead to a certain stage in which things get out of control, because any people in the history, in human history, did resist, and so will the Palestinian continue to resist. In the same time, he wished that this will continue like this forever, but I think he knows very well that it cannot continue forever, and he stated already before the last elections that there will never be a Palestinian state, and I praised him very much for this, because I thought that it's the first time he says the truth. He is against the Palestinian state, and all the rest is just rhetoric and propaganda.
Well, what does he think exists there on the West Bank and the Gaza? Obviously, it's not a state officially, but it's an awful lot of people. You can't just pretend they're not there.
First of all, you can pretend that they are not there, because Israel is dealing them as if they are not there for 47 years. So why not to go on for another 47 years?
Well, but we know what the cycle is. If the Palestinians resort to violence, then the retaliation is swift and powerful, and that then triggers more violence, and thus you spiral into another intifada. It's not hard to see the mechanism about to fall into place.
Right, but Israel and Netanyahu believe that they are strong enough militarily and they can oppress any kind of uprising by force. And they have a point. They have a point because Israel is strong enough. Yeah, it might be another bloodshed, another unpleasant period of time, but they think that it's worth it for maintaining the status quo of occupation.
Well, I don't know whether you saw the film clip of the female Israeli soldier who shot dead a Palestinian at a checkpoint, very matter-of-factly talking about it, that she, you know, the person attacked her, and she said, I just swung my weapon around and neutralized the situation. Very kind of cold, and I'm not suggesting that soldiers don't do their job, but it sort of, to me, struck me that there's a level here where perhaps Israelis don't see the humanity in the Palestinians. They just think they're wild animals that have to be shot.
That's the way they are trained to deal with them. That's the way they treat them. And the clip you saw is one of many others. When you are taught to believe that any Palestinian is a potential terrorist, and any Palestinian's life is as cheap as nothing, this is the outcome. And you had so many other examples. Yes, there are some Palestinians who really endangered the life of the soldiers, and the soldiers obviously have the right to protect themselves. But in many other cases, it was just plain killing for nothing.
So where are the other Israelis then in this? If this is not so much the dominant narrative, but the one that seems to be leading the situation at the moment.
Most of the Israelis live in a long, long denial, and they are totally unaware to the reality. And they believe that anything that happens now is a force majeure, is something that comes from heaven, like an earthquake or a flood, and nothing can be done about it. The Palestinians were born to kill, and we have to treat them according to this.
But what role does the people like Sheldon Adelson, who's put out this free newspaper that's the most popular newspaper in Israel today, that pushes this right-wing narrative, elevates Netanyahu to sort of godlike proportions? And we know that, you know, out here in California, the owner of the Bicycle Club Casinos, Irving Moskowitz, gives tons of money to West Bank settlements. The family that own Häagen-Dazs ice cream do as well. So there's a lot of Americans not just pouring money into West Bank settlements, but they're also Americans amongst the settlers. So how much is that a factor in driving this settlement narrative? And this, you mentioned, almost implied that they believe that God is their realtor.
Yeah, that goes hand to hand with the deep belief of many of the Israelis, if not most of them, that the Israelis and the Jews are the chosen people, and they have the full right on this piece of land, and they are the only one to have rights on this piece of land. And the Palestinians have two options. One is to surrender and to accept the fact that only Jews have nation rights in the land of Israel. And the other one is just to go away. And those two options are offered to them, and there is no third alternative in the eyes of racists and nationalists like Adelson and others.
But where would they go away to? I mean, the kind of wet dream has always been that somehow the Palestinians will just get tired of being beaten down and they'll slink off like a wounded dog into Jordan. As far as I can tell, that's never going to happen.
Yeah, but they have different answers. They still believe that they have 22 Arab countries and they can go there. And by the way, they're not so bad as well. Will they go? They just should disappear from this piece of land which doesn't belong to them. That's their way of thinking. The right-wingers, the racists, the nationalists, the Jewish community in the United States and in Israel.
Well, There is a slight political shift underway here in the United States, at least it seems that way, that after the last election where the Republicans controlled more of the House and took over the Senate, they seem to be having problems within their own party. The far right is attacking the vestiges of the traditional Republicans, and there's something of a civil war going on in the Republican Party, and candidates are emerging in the presidential field that are complete amateurs, some of them extremely ignorant and quite dangerous. But on the Democratic side, there's a sense that they have some fairly competent people. They even have a socialist running for president. That's, for the longest time, socialism has been a dirty word here in the United States, and that seems to be changing. So this is one way to suggest that there's a revival of the political left here in the United States. Is there any such possibility in Israel?
Not for the moment, unfortunately so. Not for the moment, by all means, not. And not for the coming years, I'm afraid.
And I take it you're a member of the Israeli left?
The Israeli left was shrinking so much, and I'm not sure that what is called Israeli left is really left.
So then, you know, if you reach a point where there's no political solution, then, you know, that really is taking you into a kind of territory of despair.
First of all, I am in territory of despair, but there is another alternative which unfortunately doesn't seem very realistic either, and this is the only hope that the world will say its word and will push Israel, and mainly that the United States will once and for all wake up and put an end to this farce in which Israel is treating the United States as if Israel is the superpower.
Well, do you think that's going to continue in the meeting between Kerry and Netanyahu in Germany next week?
No doubt. You see how the Americans flatter Israel and flatter Netanyahu again and again and do nothing. They could have done so much more to put pressure on Netanyahu. They never did. And Netanyahu, rightly so, believes that he can do whatever he wants. The American administration is deep in his pocket.
Well, but why then with Obama, you know, with a little more than a year left in office, he has nothing to lose. He can get tough, surely. He doesn't have to worry about AIPAC.
The matter of fact is that he doesn't, that he does nothing. He might be insulted personally and maybe even annoyed by Netanyahu personally, but I didn't see the Americans taking any measures to put pressure on Israel.
Well, that's pretty mystifying from a lame duck president who you would think could at some point. I mean, I know there's a long history of the influence of Israel here in the United States as such, you know, with Netanyahu being invited to speak to the Congress, that you have created a situation where there's a kind of echo chamber where, at the end of the day, Israel becomes a victim of its own excessive influence in Washington, which then results in paralysis, where they don't have to make tough decisions because they can always influence the Americans to go along with the strategy of doing nothing. But it seems to me that that can't continue forever.
Unfortunately so, but there will be one day someone who will ask, for God's sake, where is here the American interest? And the American interest for sure does not mean to continue to support Israel blindly and automatically as long as Israel continues the occupation.
Well, but you recall not so long ago, Gideon Levy, where a very frustrated John Kerry on Israeli television said, you know, what do they want? Do they want another intifada?
Yeah, but, you know, John Kerry is not an analyzer. John Kerry is the Secretary of State, and he could have done so much more to push Israel to prevent an intifada. He did nothing except of being insulted by Netanyahu and humiliated by Netanyahu.
Well, Gideon Levy, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's the former spokesman for Shimon Peres and writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature for over the last 25 years that covers the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. And his latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with a veteran CAA Middle East operative.
Well, I'm going to tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose. You fascists, bound to lose.
Woo! All you fascists, bound to lose.
I said,
all you fascists, bound to lose.
Yes,
all you fascists, bound to lose.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world alone. There's no sickness, toil or danger in that bright land to which I go. I'm going there to see my mother.
And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history, and he's the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis of the film Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Baer. He is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. His latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Good to be back, Ian.
And I'm hearing from the Air Force Special Forces people, the PJs, parachute jumpers, up at Moffett Field, that in here in California, that they've all been deployed to Incirlik, the NATO base, and to other parts of the Mediterranean around Syria. And I take it you're hearing from people in the U.S. Navy that Russian submarines are shadowing all the major capital ships of the Sixth Fleet, including the aircraft carriers off the coast of Syria. And aircraft carriers and their picket ships, their escorts, have standing orders to drop depth charges on anything that gets too close to them. So are we heading into a kind of a Cold War game of chicken in the Mediterranean?
Well, the Cold War, it's starting to look like it. I mean, our goals are so divergent in the Middle East. I mean, the fact is would like to throw out Bashar al-Assad, the leader of Syria, and the Russians want to keep him in, and so do the Iranians, and so do Hezbollah. So what we're heading for is a global conflict in the Middle East, and part of that is the Russians need access to Tartus and Latakia, the two ports in Syria. And so they're watching the American Navy very closely. And as I understand, their submarines shadowing our aircraft carriers. And as you know, Ian, those things are very vulnerable, I'd say almost obsolete. And they simply, you know, a couple of cruise missiles would sink one of them. So any, a cruise missile even coming close to one of those things by accident could trigger a conflict in the Middle East. And of course, there's the air war over Syria and the drone and violating Turkish airspace. And, you know, we're dumping weapons into Syria to groups. We don't even know who they are. And all we think they are, they're going to go after ISIS. But, who knows in that part of the world. So, and then above everything, you've got Saudi Arabia is panicking, and they are dumping money into all Islamic groups in Syria and Iraq to fight back. So, we're closer to some sort of confrontation with the Russians than we've ever been.
But the key players in this sort of proxy war in the Middle East and between Shia Islam and Sunni Islam, which of course is very much at the heart of the battle in Syria, one of the things I find ironic is that Saudi Arabia is run by the son of the king, and a lot of the princes aren't happy with him. And Iran is run by the son of Ayatollah Khamenei, Mojtaba, who's the head of the Revolutionary Guard Corps Intelligence Bureau. He is a really hardline guy who wants to succeed his father, who has terminal cancer. So Are we in a situation where the two sons of the kings, if you will, are running the show?
I think Saudi Arabia is on the brink of some sort of cataclysmic change, a coup d'etat within the royal family. The son simply taking over all functions, becoming a dictator of a country that is, you know, run by consensus traditionally. And he's only 29 years old, and he's got the economy, he's got oil, he's got defense, and the interior minister, as we've talked about, has been shunted aside, and he's doing ribbon cuttings. I just can't imagine a 30-year-old is able to rule a country under that much pressure. It's under economic pressure, unemployment, and then you've got these conflicts on its border in Syria and Iraq.
And Yemen.
And Yemen, of course, Yemen. And he and his son is in charge of the war in Yemen, and it isn't going well. They haven't pushed back the Houthis. They've overplayed what they call is like Iranian backing. It's always been marginal with the Shias of Yemen, and they're just not that involved as they are in Lebanon. So, and then you've got Iran, which economically is suffering, you know, horribly, and you know, and then you got this power struggle, and the father is just like in Saudi Arabia is dying, and is probably suffering some sort of dementia. And so a power struggle in the two main players in the Middle East certainly isn't going to add to the stability of the place.
So what do you think has happened here with the P5+1 deal, where there was an expectation, at least among some analysts, that the U.S. and the West would benefit from an opening with Iran, and that somehow Rouhani, if he got the deal, which he finally has, would be able to lead the country away from its focus on you know, the hardline policies of Hezbollah, Hamas, and et cetera. But the opposite seems true, that immediately that the deal is signed, it becomes clear that Russia and the Iranian hardliners in charge of the country, the Kurds, the IRGC, et cetera, are very active, very involved, both in Syria with both Russian and Iranian troops now deployed. The general impression is, because I was puzzled at the time the deal was made, why would Russia sign off on a deal that will allow Iranian oil to go on the market, which would further depress the price of oil, that would, you know, further affect Russia's economy? But they seem to be looking at some other bigger picture. So what's your take on this?
Well, the bigger picture is pretty much the way I look at it, too, is it's a lot easier to deal with the Iranians and Hezbollah, for that matter, than it is the Sunni crazies, I mean, who believe they're facing extinction as a sect. And Russia has always been against this greater, you know, Sunni alliance, which we supported in the Afghan war, and they're getting revenge. And they have inroads into Iran, weapon systems, they're saying oil, refineries, all sorts of stuff. Economically, they're going to benefit from Iran. And Iran is run by the IRGC in so many ways. And especially the intelligence unit, and always has been. It's always been the spear point of Iranian foreign policy. And the president, from Rafsanjani on, have been fairly weak. And I think, for pragmatic reasons, they signed this nuclear deal, which is good in general. But that didn't mean what we all hoped, there'd be some sort of great detente with Iran, and that we, for instance, would help the Iranians and the Shia government Baghdad to defeat ISIS. They're not ready to cross that line, especially when they got Russia backing them 100%. And I think Putin really doesn't care much about the economy. He feels he can live with low oil prices for a long time, sort of like the Saudis can. He just has to keep the army supplied, and he has these grandiose views of bringing Russia back. He thinks they were defeated when the Berlin Wall fell. He was betrayed by Moscow. He that narrative he sort of lives off of. He stopped the mobs in Dresden, and if there had been more Russians like him, the Soviet Union wouldn't have collapsed. So he sees himself in a historical role, and he needs an important ally, and that's Iran. And right now, with us having a schizophrenic policy in the Middle East, I mean, you know, the neocons put a Shia government in power in Baghdad. It now, we decided it wasn't such a good idea. And with Syria, we had this fantasy that democracy was going to flourish in 2011, which was never in the cards. And we just sort of got carried along with the Arab Spring. And now we don't know what to do. And we don't have a plan, and the Russians do.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis of the film Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Baer. He is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. But in terms of Putin's mindset and outlook, which you've described, going back to his experience in Dresden, where he watched in humiliation as Stasi headquarters across the street were sacked and could barely hold on to the KGB office in Dresden, and all he could take back to Russia with him was a washing machine, which... The Russian Empire was a peculiar one where people on the periphery had a higher standard of living than people back at home. But one of the things that I understand that really motivated him as a former KGB officer and a minor one at that is this: the principal enemy theory, that the United States is the principal enemy. And it seems that his focus is on whatever he can do to stitch up the Americans. I mean, that seems to be where he's at. You know, he's like got this huge grudge that whatever they do, he's going to make sure it causes, he finds a way to cause America pain.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, he's thinking in large strategic brushstrokes, and we don't do that. I mean, we think about getting American politicians to the next election, and our foreign policy debates are just frankly idiotic, you know. And he looks at the United States as the main enemy. We brought the Soviet Union down in the sense that Afghanistan broke them in the 80s. And he thinks it's winnable, especially since he's a major supplier of gasoline and gas to Europe. They really can't survive without the Russians, and no one's done anything about the Crimea or eastern Ukraine or shooting the Malay airplane down. There's been no real investigation on that, and there's been no consequences for them. I mean, I'm not suggesting that we go toe-to-toe with Putin. I just want to get inside his mind, and you're absolutely right. There's this bloody mindset of revenge that he's looking out for, and he also feels... the Russia was betrayed because they allowed and they encouraged the invasion of Afghanistan in October 2001. Had the overflights, they supplied the fuel, they sort of did anything we asked, and then we turned around for no apparent reason and took down their ally, erstwhile allies, Saddam Hussein, in an act of complete folly. And they look at the same way with Bashar al-Assad. Why should we take down their Middle East allies and friends with impunity and with no plan to follow up? And in a sense, he's right. You know, it's fine to get rid of Bashar al-Assad, but what are you going to replace him with, and how fast? And destroying Syria as a country, and I mean, it is destroyed for hundreds of years. Isn't such a good plan. So you really have to get inside the Russian mind, see where they're right, and see where they're just vengeful.
Well, but I think more to the point, isn't what's happening now an indication of how wrong we are? I mean, everybody on the West and Europe and in the United States seems to have gotten it wrong. They've been wrong-footed. Look at this refugee crisis. I mean, that's not exactly a surprise. There were millions of people stuck in camps in Turkey, and the Turks ran out of money. They spent $5 billion. The Europeans haven't. Now they're freaked out because all these people are showing up on their doorstep. It just seems like we're just, Putin knows what the hell he's doing, and we don't have a clue what we're doing.
Russia is a blunt instrument, and they're going to make hideous mistakes in the Middle East. You can count on that. But you're absolutely right, and of course it goes back to the invasion of Iraq. This is what really started it all. We brought down a dictator and everybody else, so that's a good idea. And they kicked the Syrians out of Lebanon in 2005, and it was sort of game on. And we had these fantasies about a Jeffersonian democracy, and we have absolutely no depth in the Middle East, and we have nobody really talking to us. And so, yeah, he is right in that sense. And if the invasion of Iraq ends up in driving 50, 100 million refugees into Europe, and that's not a crazy number, you're going to see, I'm just sure of it, you're seeing in Germany, it's fascism in Europe. There's going to be this backlash against immigrants, a backlash against any sort of liberalism or accepting, and Europe will be changed thanks to our, unconsidered policies in the Middle East.
So do you think that any of what we're talking about Obama been briefed on this kind of stuff? I mean, I know that Brennan, the head of the CIA, is in the process of destroying the CIA.
he's dismantling the CIA.
Right.
Completely. And the State Department is forbidden from talking to, for instance, the few Sunnis left in Anbar. We don't really talk to the Syrians in any degree. And we're running this whole war on terror with algorithms. I mean, these recent releases on The Intercept, 90 out of 100 people were killing with drones are just completely innocent, unconnected to any terrorism at all. And you simply cannot run a war with drones and algorithms. It just doesn't work.
But that's Mr. Brennan. He's Mr. Drone.
He's Mr. Drone. That's his stripes. And everybody at JSOC. More raids are done with drones in JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command, than there are commando raids. And commando raids are of limited use, and they always have been. And you simply, it's fantasy to think you can fight wars in the Middle East with a handful of special operators. They may be very good, but they don't win wars.
Well, Robert Baird, just in closing, just to answer the question about what kind of information do you think Obama's getting? Because he seems to basically have a holding pattern, and he's going to basically, whoever succeeds him is going to inherit this mess. Is there anything that you think he's aware of that he could do?
I happen to think the man is very, very smart, and he understands he was dealt a terrible deck, terrible hand, and he's just kicking the can down the road like so many presidents do, sort of like on the Israeli-Palestinian problem, just kick the can down the road, let somebody else deal with the consequences when the whole thing explodes. And maybe at the end of the day, there's nothing to do about the Middle East that we can do. Everything we've ever tried there has ultimately failed. Maybe it's just not fixable from a country that's halfway around the world and not very good at foreign policy.
Well, Robert Baird,
I know that's not very optimistic, but I don't feel that way.
Well, it was a good note to end on, one way or the other, and I thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Baird, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis of the film Syriana, which earns George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Baird. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about what seems to be the inexorable rise of the Islamic State.
اكتب واخط بالقلم بالقلم اكتب واخط بالقلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي واسيني.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jobi Warwick, who has been a reporter for The Washington Post since 1996. He's a winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism and the author of Triple Agent. His latest book just out is Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jobi Warwick.
Ian, good to be with you.
And Jobi, the book traces the rise of this virulent strain of militant Islam behind ISIS, and it begins in a remote Jordanian prison, and it spread, of course, with, as you point out, with the unwitting aid of two American presidents. That's clearly something that we have to talk about. But let's start with some of the heroes, if you will, in terms of those that warned, the Cassandras, the young woman analyst at the CIA, and the diplomat who urged Obama to stop the movement before it spreads. And, of course, King Abdullah of Jordan, who comes across as a kind of Cassandra-like figure. Clearly, all of the above were either ignored or weren't sufficiently taken seriously. But describe some of these people and the heroic efforts that they made.
You're absolutely right, because they're, you know, this is not a brand new problem, and we all became aware of it really just in the summer of 2014. But this has been brewing for really at least 15 years since the start of the jihadist movement, and there have been many heroes really along the way who've seen what was coming and tried, you know, very clearly to warn everyone what was going on. I talk a lot about the King of Jordan in this book because he's from this country that has the front row seat on the conflict and is bordered by Syria and Iraq, so he's right in the middle of it. And he got a lot of trouble in the 2000s by, you know, publicly begging the Bush administration not to invade Iraq. He said, of course, you can you know, knock out Saddam Hussein's army in a couple of weeks. There's nobody questioning that. He said, you're going to open a Pandora's box. And he got chewed out by the Bush administration, you know, privately and publicly sometimes. But he was absolutely right about that. And he was also right in warning that if we allowed Syria to become, you know, this vacuum without at least, you know, doing more to try to prevent the worst elements from coming into Syria, that was going to be a problem too. And all of it, of course, has led to the situation we're in today.
Well, unfortunately, there's been no reckoning for what the Israeli historian Martin Van Creewel described as the worst political blunder since Emperor Augustus sent his armies into Germany in 9 BC, or 9 AD, I should say. And the neocons have been held for count, and Bush and Cheney, and of course, Bush's brother Jeb is defending him on the campaign trail. So we obviously have an historical amnesia here in the United States, but that doesn't mean that that the Islamic State is going away. I mean, is what President Obama is doing now a sort of just a cosmetic management situation where he's going to turn this thing over to his successor?
You know, I think everyone's quite resigned to the fact that we're going to be dealing with this problem for a long time. And, you know, the Russian involvement really just makes it worse in the sense that it's inflamed, you know, multiple sides. There was some hope in the beginning that it might prop some kind of political settlement. Right now, it just seems to be just adding fuel to the fire. And the administration, I think they've been in a difficult position the whole time. We were in uncharted waters with the Arab Spring movement, and nobody really knew what to do with these incredible forces that were released in the Middle East, including in Syria. And so there was a lot of sitting back and waiting for things to sort themselves out. I remember covering this conflict, you know, as it began, and the great expectation that everyone had was that Assad was going to fall like Mubarak did in Egypt, and we'll come in, help up, pick up the pieces. And no one was prepared for what happened, which was that, you know, Assad managed to hang on with help from some very powerful friends and, you know, led us to this stalemate we're in, and that allowed the worst elements to slip into the country.
And again, I'm speaking with Jobi Warwick, who's been a reporter for The Washington Post since 1996. He's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism and the author of Triple Agent. His latest book just out is Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS. So just preceding you on the program today, we were speaking with Robert Baer, the Middle East CIA operative, and also I've spoken with Richard Barrett, who is a former MI6 Middle East expert. Both of these gentlemen speak Arabic, and I've spoken to them subsequent to when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi made his appearance, I think, at the mosque in Mosul. And although it was widely dismissed as, you know, that this group are a bunch of thugs usurping Islam, both Robert Baer and Richard Barrett said that Baghdadi actually was quite coherent in his you know, I guess it's, I can't think of the word in terms of theology, but his sermon, shall we say.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is not amateur hour in the sense that these guys were not prepared. They knew exactly what they were doing. They've had this goal in mind, which is to create an Islamic caliphate in the region as quickly as possible. That's something that dates back from, you know, from the 2000s and Zarqawi's time. And the idea is you declare it and people will come. You give people a cause to fight for. You sort of outline very clearly who the enemies are, and you know how Sunni Muslims are being oppressed. And here's sort of a call to arms for like-minded people around the world to come and help the cause. And so they took over these cities in Iraq. They've got their territory, which is something that no terrorist group, as we know it, has really done to this degree, you know, ever in modern times. And they're holding on to them. There's no sign at this point that Mosul is going to be going back to the Iraqi government anytime soon. So they, in a very real sense, they do have their caliphate right now.
But since Baghdadi has expropriated Abu Bakr, which is, you know, the most potent symbol of Sunni Islam that you could have, along with Baghdad, of course, that resonates. In terms of the caliphate, to my mind, the caliphate ultimately means the holy shrines of Mecca and Medina. And we have a very, in a macro sense, a very unstable Middle East, where the Saudis are led by a 30-year-old son of an alien king who's increasingly unpopular with his fellow princes. And on the Iranian side of this sort of proxy war between Shias and Sunni is the son, Mojtaba Khamenei, the son of the supreme leader who, I believe, has terminal cancer, and the son is also the head of the Revolutionary Guard Corps Intelligence Bureau that essentially runs Iran. Isn't that a bit peculiar? You've got two 30-year-olds, or no, actually much older than that, but you've got the sons of the leaders vying for power in the midst of a proxy war, and at the end of the day, the goal is who controls Mecca and Medina.
Yeah, that's true, and this is it's interesting because in the case of both Iran and Iraq, we're used to seeing, Saudi Arabia, countries that have been ruled by very old men, and one would hope that a new generation would bring them some more flexibility and maybe some more pragmatism into the region, but it's looking perhaps the contrary, that there's both sides are spoiling in a way for this conflict that's been, you know, underlying relations between these two, you know, parts of the Islamic religion for centuries. And you know, I think that the Syrian conflict in many ways is that conflict, you know, brought to reality with the Iranians backing the Alawites and Shiites and the Sunnis on their side. So it's and you have these governments, you know, with lots of money at their disposal, you know, egging them on and supplying and, you know, sending money and arms and people. So it's a very dangerous situation.
But to understand the ultimate ambitions of ISIS, aren't they really challenging the Saudi claims of being the legitimate custodians of the Holy Shrine?
Exactly. And this is something that we saw somewhat with bin Laden, but much more so with these people. They don't recognize, you know, the modern Arab states as legitimate at all. They see them as creations of the colonial powers of the West, that they were essentially made to divide the Muslim world and also to prop up Western interests. And they Zarqawi, who's sort of the godfather of ISIS, you know, called very directly for the, you know, for these rulers to be put to death, and he thinks that, you know, that all these boundaries should be erased. There should be no Jordan. There should be no Iraq, it should be this one caliphate with Mecca as the capital. And I think that's what they'd like to see happen. And I don't think they have a chance of realizing that, but that's their ambition, and they're serious about it.
Well, but when you say they don't have a chance, here they are still, in spite of restrictions and bombing, constant bombing, we're told, and now the Russians are starting to bomb. The recruitment continues, particularly in the diaspora. The appeal's not going away. And my understanding of Saudi Arabia is that this royal family that run the country is a kind of a family operation. There's divisions within that family over what they consider the immaturity of the king's son, who's got all these portfolios and is pursuing a war in Yemen that's not going to go well. And the price of oil, of course, and they're spending money like crazy, and they're now pouring arms into Syria. They have a compact with the Wahhabi sect that are sort of co-rulers, if you will. And is there a potential that the Wahhabis could just suddenly switch overnight and say, okay, you guys are the new caliphate, come on in?
You know, there's definitely many similarities between the theology of the Wahhabis, which is and the belief system of the ISIS folks. I think what's going to stop ISIS from advancing further, I think there's no question we're going to see more terrorism and more problems on the Arab Peninsula. And despite the Saudis' pretty robust security system, you know, we're seeing already more infiltration and more attacks that take place. But there are a lot of people with a lot of resources to be brought to bear, and they have a lot at stake in this conflict. So I think that we'll probably see more and more repressive policies that'll try to keep ISIS-like thinkers from coming into the kingdom. But they do have a challenge, I think, you know, for years to come, just trying to keep this problem from bubbling up and really affecting them. And they have a lot to do with the fact that we're in this conflict to begin with. They've had a lot to do with funding some of the groups that we're now concerned about. But now they've got a problem as well.
But this seems really intractable, doesn't it, Joby Warrick, in as much as if the Saudis and the U.S. is also dumping ammunition into the Syrian front against the Russians, the Iranians, and Hezbollah and the remnants of Assad, I believe the Saudis are also pouring on as well because of, you know, Russia and Iran are deploying troops on the other side. And so isn't that inherent conflict there? Well, on the one hand, the Saudis are, in effect, stimulating, feeding, propagating the Islamic State in Syria, at the same time afraid of it within their own borders.
Absolutely, and I think at the same time, neither side seems to be powerful enough to shove the other one out. I think what we're seeing with Russia and Iran now supporting the Assad government, I think there was a real concern that Assad was teetering. But Russia has made very clear that they're not going to let that happen, so they're propping up their guy. I think there's a limit to what they're willing to do. They're not going to send the kinds of ground troops into Syria that would allow them to really reclaim territory. I think they're going to solidify the centers of power where Assad has his strongholds, but they're not about to push ISIS out of Raqqa by themselves. And on the other hand, the Saudis and other Arab states are not going to let Assad defeat the groups that they're supporting. So there's no indication at all that this is about to go away, and I think there's every belief and every reason to believe it's going to get worse.
So when President Obama somewhat defensively says that we've got a coalition of 60 nations and the Russians have just got the Iranians and Hezbollah and Assad and they're going to rue the day they got deeper involved in Syria, what's happening with the 60-nation coalition? The Saudis are a part of it. Again, aren't they stuck with the same contradiction?
And there's also just a lack of willingness to really commit forces. I mean, it seems a few countries, the Jordanians, the UAE, some sorties by the Saudis, but in terms of having, munitions and weapon systems in the region, they're much happier to arm rivals, or arm their proxies, rather, and donate money to groups that they think are helpful to them. But they haven't been able, they haven't been willing to do the kind of commitment that you'd think would be needed to really change the situation on the ground, which, again, just means there's just sort of an endless supply of people willing to fight and weapons and ammunition to fight with, but not enough to really be decisive to push the conflict one way or the other. So we're stuck, I think, for a long time.
Right, but that's where Russia prolonging it is a major wrinkle. But assuming that they hadn't stepped in and that eventually Assad would have fallen, my understanding is that there's always been an assumption that once the Syrian war ends, the second Syrian war begins, which is the war against the Islamic State. And is that still a possibility? I've heard often of the what they call the flypaper strategy, where they get all the bad guys into one spot and kill them. That, you know, that may be a fantasy at this point, given Russia's involvement. But do you accept the premise that at the end of the day, something's going to have to be done about all these people?
And I think that's been the belief all along by some of the parties to this conflict. I remember as early as 2012 talking to some regional officials very close to the conflict with their proxy people involved and donating to, you know, to their side. And they said, you know, once this is over, yeah, it looks really messy right now. Yeah, there's some really, insidious characters involved in this conflict. We know who they are. We know where they are. And after this is over, we're going to take care of them. Well, that was, you know, 3 years ago, and now it's, you know, how many troops does ISIS have at its disposal? And even if, you know, at some point in the future, ISIS can be driven out of eastern Syria and Raqqa is in the control of the government, you still have this problem of many, many people trained by ISIS, indoctrinated by ISIS, living, you know, throughout the Middle East and around the world, including in this country. And that's going to be the gift to keep giving for years to come. So even if we can, you know, assert control over the region, it's not the end of the problem.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Joby Warrick. And obviously, to find out more about this, how this virulent strain of militant Islam has spread with the rise of ISIS and how it began in a remote Jordanian prison and spread with the unwitting aid of two American presidents, and all to find out about the young woman analyst at the CIA who tried to raise the alarm, along with the diplomat who also tried to raise the alarm, and King Abdullah of Jordan, who Joby just pointed out, got the door to the Oval Office was shut on him because he was telling the truth. So all of the above are available in Joby's new book. And I thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you again for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Joby Warrick, who has been a reporter for The Washington Post since 1996. He is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism and the author of Triple Agent. And his latest book just out is Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. Scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by